very quickly, I wanted to say that our panelists are Jennifer Bellamy, assistant professor at SSA, Professor Harold Briggs from the School of Social Work at Portland State University, and Stanley McCracken, senior lecturer here at SSA. Each of these panelists brings significant experience in implementing evidence-based practice in real-world agencies. Their work is positioned at the confluence of intervention research, which seeks to develop and test efficacious treatments, and organizational research that attempts to understand and improve the ways in which the innovations of research make their way into practice with the clients they're designed to help. With that, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you. You all, I'm going to, first of all, congratulate you on a fine job of staying awake. I had to take my jacket off because I was actually having a problem. So I'm going to cut to the chase. I'm going to cut a lot out of my presentation because it won't fit within the 15 minutes that I've been provided. So that being said, I'm going to cut right to the chase. You see, the name of my presentation is Diffusing and Adopting Evidence-Based Practice and Evidence-Supported Interventions, Lessons Learned Through SSA. Okay, let's get to the point. Now, the dean mentioned, you know, earlier that we need to start speaking about the obstacles and challenges and barriers to actually using innovations like evidence-based practice and evidence-supported interventions. My usage of the term evidence-supported interventions is synonymous with Tina's usage of evidence-based practice as a noun. So when I refer to evidence-based practice, I'm talking about the five stepwise process. And when I use empirically supported interventions, I'm speaking about a single method that has a very strong research base. When I put together all of the experiences that I've had as an executive director and as a consultant to various organizations across the country, and the work that I'm doing in a couple of large state agencies in Oregon actually comprise the evidence of my presentation. What I'm going to be talking about are lessons learned and observations made with respect to diffusing and adopting evidence-based practice and empirically supported interventions. With respect to challenges in adopting each of them, we notice in the child welfare industry that there is a great deal of resistance to evidence-based practice and evidence-supported interventions. There's no money to finance technology transfer and to actually make sure that people are properly trained, supervised, or there's appropriate monitoring going on of the change process with respect to innovations. We know that in most child welfare agencies, and this is not just exclusive to child welfare, but let's also consider the area of mental health, there's a lack of a culture of learning. Very little questioning and skepticism that really drives the organizational environment. There's a lot of resistance to empirically supported interventions, and you've already heard quite a bit of those noted this morning, but I'm going to go over some of them. One in particular is a cultural challenge, and what I want to point out here is that empirically supported interventions were primarily developed with too few or no people of color in the samples. Only recently do we have a few empirically supported interventions that have sufficient enough people of color in their sample size for the findings and the results to actually be statistically significant for this particular group. But these are very rare. On a side note, the compatibility between evidence-based practice and cultural competence is well established. I just completed, before I got on the plane, yesterday, a special issue of Children and Youth Service Review, and the name of it is Evidence-Based Practice in a Cultural Context. And we had a meeting similar to this one 2 years ago at University of Minnesota in the School of Social Work, where we sat and talked very openly about the fusion of evidence-based practice and cultural competence. With respect to the five types of knowledge that I mentioned earlier, one of those types of knowledge is cultural knowledge. Evidence-based practice allows you to use client knowledge, scientific knowledge, practitioner knowledge, implementation knowledge, and cultural knowledge. Empirically supported interventions only allow you to use scientific knowledge. Go figure. Okay. We have consumer challenges that we have to be concerned about when we look at empirically supported and evidence-supported interventions. Consumers may lack knowledge of available effective services. They may have limited advocacy skills with respect to being able to request or demand that effective services be available to them. The overemphasis on empirically supported interventions means that the five-step process of evidence-based practice, which brings in client input, client values, and other types of knowledge bases, are ignored and not considered. There's a fundamental problem with respect to the field of social work in the area of empirically supported interventions when we consider the fact that most people think with two random clinical trial observations, we now are certain and we can guarantee effectiveness. Now that's inappropriate. Now, let's talk about the agency and service provider challenges, and there are many. There seems to be a lack of staff buy-in. The whole issue of top-down directives really doesn't go well when you're trying to anchor in something new. You know, change is hard, as we all know, but in particular with respect to a practice or a process, we really need buy-in at the lower level. So one of the things that struck me when I was doing my work here in Chicago as an agency exec, I involved the parents, the families, the staff, and foster parents, a few consumers who had already done well. I involved them as part of a champion change catalyst system in order to usher in the planning, implementation, and some quality assurance activities to make sure that what we said we would do, we actually did. Very important to actually empower all levels of an infrastructure of an organization to be involved. We also note that with respect to the managed care system, the reimbursement practices of managed care may interfere with the implementation of empirically supported interventions. They may not pay for certain interventions and they may pay for others. The vision, values, and goals of the empirically supported intervention developer are quite different than the values and the experiences and the demands on the part of the administrator and the staff in an agency. They really don't have time to really think about doing things according to fidelity sometimes. Quite frankly, when we talk about following fidelity, that's following a prescription, a recipe. Very few people actually have found that they actually follow something that was written through the format of a recipe. There's always a natural tendency to adapt and change. But we do have purists in the field who feel very strongly that if we do not follow and implement empirically supported interventions in the way they were designed and tested, then we won't be actually experiencing the full change that is promised with respect to the empirically supported intervention. Again, I go back and suggest to you that just because we have two random observations doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be effective all the time. If we think that way, think about the Food and Drug Administration, if they only use two observations in order to approve medicine for you. Wouldn't like it, would you? Listen, I'll try to rush through these challenges and so that we can talk about how to fix these. Stan and Jennifer will talk about the next set of considerations. So I won't duplicate the effort. But in their talk, they're going to talk about ways in which, through various projects that they're engaged in, how they've addressed some of these concerns and some of the considerations I have up here. For example, the social network consideration. If people in your agency are not doing the change or not following the innovation, then more than likely they're not expecting you to. The political considerations for empirically supported interventions in Oregon are different than most states. Oregon is one of the few states that has legislation for evidence-supported interventions. It's Senate Bill 267, and the legislation is very clear that in order to be reimbursed for health and human services, state agencies and providers who receive contracts through them have to provide services that have been deemed empirically, that have been constituted as an evidence-supported intervention, or they call them evidence-based programs. And if you don't, then the likelihood of your reimbursement coming through is going to be very unlikely. A few things in trying to rush through this presentation, I did come across a paper that I just submitted to the Journal of Social Work Education on the institutional context of evidence-based practice in the academy. What I have found is that there's very few incentives for schools of social work to teach the five-step process. It's very, very, not confusing, but it's very, it's a gray area with respect to what type or which types of evidence approaches people can, it's very loose in definition, so people can actually avoid evidence-based practice altogether. They can use empirically supported interventions, or they might be able to use what I asked the dean earlier about was practice-based evidence. And those are single methods that are that have no research base, and actually you are evaluating them as you apply them. It's possible to get to practice-based evidence through the five-step process. No one says that you have to use an empirically supported intervention. The client has the choice, and if they choose to use a practice, a procedure, or methods with very little or no research base, that's their choice. Okay? So, with respect to one of the things that I did in a trial study with a parent advocate, foster parent in St. Louis, I taught her the five-step process. And between her suggestions and our experiences of trying to, let me see it, pardon me, I'm getting ahead of myself. What we did was to try to take the technical aspect out of the five-step process and to make it a friendly experience for her. So she told me, she said, "You're teaching me like you would teach your students, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." Yeah. She said, "Don't do that to me." She said, "What I need you to do is to talk story like we do to each other. We're both African American. We tell stories as part of our cultural background." So she said, "Talk to me. Give me a character like Nemo and give me the analogy in the cartoon of Nemo to what you're trying to do with me here." So it suddenly dawned on me that I needed to use an oral tradition with my people, in this particular case, to teach her how to develop a Cope's question. At that point, we developed a fill-in-the-blank format that allowed her just to fill things in as I probed questions and she gave me answers. We just put them, we actually set up the effectiveness question and drew blanks, and she said, "Well, what we would put here is a culturally sensitive prayer approach versus standard information and referral." So we went through these kinds of exercises so that she could acquire mastery of each step. It worked, and what I learned from that, quite frankly, is that I needed to come up with some culturally enriched roles that would actually assist family members and people who are lay community workers in being able to use this technology. So what I came up with were five roles. The first one, the guide. The guide helps the parent develop the COPES question. The interpreter retrieves the output from the COPES question and lays out the array of options for the family member. The researcher performs the critical analysis of the reliability and validity of the intervention and the evaluation method. The translator deconstructs all the science and puts it in user-friendly information and juxtaposes the client's cultural customs and experiences with each option to see if there's some equivalent units there. And the last thing, the advocate assists in implementation and also provides other services and supports around social justice. In the years that I managed a few agencies and I did consultation, I acquired 10 lessons that I would like to share with you that I feel that would be very helpful in people being able to actually work on the challenges that I mentioned before and also acquire a change in agency culture that would invite different evidence-based perspectives. The first is establish an agency-wide culture of learning. The second, adopt a strong emphasis on experimentation and trial and error. Use evidence-based practice as an ethical framework to engage in transparency and tracking of successes and errors. Establish diffusion. Now, this is very important here because now this is what happened when I walked in these doors September 1978. I received the fusion of problem-solving, information literacy, research utilization, decision-making, critical appraisal, and critical thinking skills as core competencies. That's what I got here. I got that through task-centered and also through the problem-oriented practice sequence, which was adapted in 1978 to be called a core curriculum. And there were seven different ways to practice social work, and one of them was an empirical approach. And in that empirical approach, all of these were the basic functions that we learned in both first and second year. Oh, my goodness. Did I do that? I made a faux pas. Actually, I assumed something. The first step of evidence-based practice is to design an answerable question, and that is the client-oriented, practical, evidence search question. Thank you for that. Sure. Client, oriented, practical, evidence, search. Okay. Thank you. Okay, number six, important one. Employ evidence-based management approaches, which includes the three different models for evidence-based management. And I know you all haven't heard of it, have you? How many people have heard of evidence-based management? You have. We're going to talk about where you heard about it from later. There are three approaches to evidence-based management. One is continuous quality improvement. The second one is marrying information literacy to decision-making, and it's an eight-step process. The third one is a five-step process similar to the five-step process in evidence-based practice, but it focuses on administrative and management databases, because the unit of attention is to address administrative related issues, organizational issues that impact on your ability to be effective with your client base. Okay, how am I doing on time? Oh, I'm at the end. Okay, why don't we just simply have you look at those last few? Thank you for your patience. And you can ask questions after my other two presenters are finished. Thank you.
sorry. Despite being an evidence-based practice person, I actually have very little technical skill at all. So I need a little assistance with the slides there. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon and talk about one of my favorite topics in the whole world, evidence-based practice. Today I'm going to share with you a project that I was involved in as a PhD student at Columbia University, where I was working with Edward Mullen, whose name was mentioned earlier today. And I worked with him as well as with a few of my other colleagues whose names are listed here. So I just want to acknowledge not only their contribution to this project, but also the contribution of our community partners. And I'll tell you a little bit more about them. Unfortunately, I don't list their names here for reasons of confidentiality, just sort of a strange thing that I don't get to acknowledge them by name, but I do want to acknowledge them in spirit. So the title of this presentation, Addressing the Barriers to Evidence-Based Implementation in Social Work, Reflections from the BEST Project, is just to orient you to the fact that I'm going to focus a lot on addressing barriers, some of which other presenters have referred to in different ways and by different names today. But BEST stands for Bringing Evidence for Social Work Training, so BEST. Although we have this argument in our group, I always thought it was Bringing Evidence to Social Work Training. But my colleagues told me, no, I had that wrong. And this project was supported, led by Edward Mullen and supported by the Wilma and Albert Musher program at Columbia University School of Social Work. So I want to start with you sort of where we started as a research team, which was to review the literature that existed at the time of this project's beginning. So in 2003, when I was a PhD student coming into Columbia University, and actually I walked in the door, and about the first thing that Edward Mullen said to me, my advisor in the program, was, have you ever heard of evidence-based practice? And I said, no. Should I have? Actually, I had no idea what he was talking about. But he made a fast convert out of me in one of the first projects that I engaged in with him as a student was to conduct a literature review. And I should say, with all honesty, nothing at all like a systematic review. You should appreciate that. And you'll appreciate it more after I think you hear Julia Littell's presentation. So, in all honesty, this was not all that systematic. And we also, Betsy Bledsoe and Dorian Traub were two other PhD students who were also being trained by Ed Mullen at the school. And we did this literature review, and we also talked to some experts, albeit a convenient sample, meaning these were people that we had easy access to because they had some, you know, relationship with the Columbia University School of Social Work. I'm trying to be transparent. Just to be a good model of evidence-based social work and my commitment to transparency, so I'm laying it out there for you as it is. But I do think we did learn something, despite the very sort of exploratory nature of our work at this point, and really it continued to be exploratory in nature. But we sort of categorized the barriers that we unearthed in our literature review and in our discussions with experts, and we organized them into these sort of four categories. The first one, suspicion and distrust. So this is just the general perception that researchers and all things related to research are not to be trusted, that we simply don't know what we're doing in terms of practice, and the idea that some sort of muckety-muck from the ivory tower might know how to do intervention better than somebody who's an expert in the field. Just doesn't make sense. So that's sort of an attitude barrier, I guess. Also, this lack of knowledge in a very broad sense, knowledge of what is evidence-based practice. We started today with some definitions, and I think that was really important. But also lack of knowledge around how to access and critically evaluate and then apply research, which is a very difficult process. Also, the limited resources, these are other issues that have come up today, limits in terms of time, in terms of the expense and training that it takes to implement new practices in research, and also this lack of fit, which includes some of these issues around developing research interventions with populations that look not very much at all like the folks that we're working with, but a general sense of that the existing research doesn't really help all that much in the real world. So we, after sort of doing this literature review and these interviews, and also in recognition that there's just, this was a mounting interest and pressure to use evidence-based practice, despite my ignorance of that mounting pressure, just the recognition that in the face of all of these barriers, we were unlikely to see any movement forward in terms of increasing the use of evidence-based practice in social work without developing some specific approaches to support evidence-based practice in social work. And we, through discussions and brainstorming, came up with this notion of partnerships, university-agency partnerships that might work together. And some of this came from, we were kind of frustrated with this message that seemed to be coming from sort of the research world that had a really blamey sort of orientation. Hey, practitioners, why aren't you using our fantastic research in your practice? What's wrong with you? Why don't, we develop all these great interventions, but people aren't using them, or they aren't using them right, and, shame on you practice folks out there. And we found that this is a really unproductive approach to the problem, and so we really wanted to partner with and collaborate practitioners and recognize their particular expertise and knowledge and work together to sort of figure out how this might happen. It was very much an exploratory pilot project. We went in from the beginning with not too much of a clue about what we were actually going to do other than partner with people, agencies, to support evidence-based practice in their agencies, and really thinking about questions around feasibility and acceptability for whatever we did together. And what we came up with in collaboration with agencies and discussions was to develop a hands-on evidence-based practice team training experience. And we very much developed this training on the work of Len Gibbs. His name has been mentioned before. And he has a wonderful resource, evidence-based practice, I believe, for the helping professions. The title, did I get that right? Yeah. So he had developed all of these great instruments, some that looked sort of like what Harold was just talking about earlier, where it was sort of a fill-in-the-blank form. Mm-hmm. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with this but want to learn more, I think it's a great sort of resource to start with. And so we used what the materials that Gibbs had created, the exercises, the worksheets and things like that, to develop 10 training modules, which we delivered in three different New York City agencies, very different social service agencies. One was sort of a child and family agency located in Brooklyn that worked primarily with families who were immigrants, mostly Latino families. We worked with another agency that provided health services in Chinatown to a primarily, again, immigrant population, but coming from a different part of the world. And then we finally worked with a much larger child and family services agency, ultimately working in a program that was designed for people who were transitioning from psychiatric or substance abuse treatment into the community. A lot of serious or persistent mental illnesses and people struggling with substance abuse issues. And within each of these agencies, we worked with administrators to choose teams who would ultimately receive this training. And these teams consisted of 4 to 6 agency participants, clinicians, supervisors, administrators, and in one case, we even had a student on the team, and they partnered with two doctoral students, myself and Betsy Bledsoe, actually delivered the training. And the data on which we will draw some conclusions today were collected primarily through focus groups that we did. We did focus groups with these agency teams at baseline or before we conducted the training, and then we conducted another focus group post-training. And then we actually brought participants from all three agencies together about 3 months after the project was completed to sort of check up on them and see how things were going. We also took a lot of meeting notes and collected other documents along the way to sort of learn from this experience. I should also say, in the spirit of transparency, you know, there's always sort of an issue if the person who's created the intervention, or in this case the training, is also measuring it. So I want to be very transparent about that bias as well. So I just want to talk with you, I'm running out of time like everyone else today, about going back to those barriers, what we did to sort of address each of them. And the first one, that suspicion and distrust, and I think I already mentioned, we really engaged agencies from the get-go. They were the ones who said, we actually presented this whole noun-verb problem to them. Well, do you want to take a single intervention and sort of work with us to implement that in your agency, or are you more attracted to this process notion where you sort of learn to do that? And unanimously, they said, the process. We want to learn the process. We don't want you to come in and just implement this intervention with our teams. They also said, we want to work in teams. We don't want you to train individual practitioners. We want you to bring people together. That's how we work. We work in teams. So those are a couple of big learnings that we had. I'm going to move quickly through these and not mention every point. I apologize for that. Also, addressing this lack of knowledge. Well, it was a training, and the training was also... we settled on training in part because agencies said that was something very valuable to them, to get some free, high-quality training in their agency at their convenience. And we were there to provide them with sort of immediate in-person technical assistance as they walk through this process for the first time. So we keep talking about the steps of the process, where we construct a COPES question and we find the evidence. And you have to critically evaluate it, and then you have to apply it. And a lot of that involves a lot of complex expertise about research and interpretation. And so by joining the teams in the hands-on training, walking through the process, we were there as researchers to be sort of a backup and explain, you know, what is an effect size, or how do I interpret this graph? Also, we try to address limited agency researchers, resources by creating a modular training, that 10 modules. So in one agency said, it's easier for us to do two big blocks of training. So we presented 5 modules in each day. Mm-hmm. Another agency said, no, we'd like to integrate this into our usual training and supervision processes. And so we did 1 module with them each day over the course of several weeks. I should say these modules, all these training materials, are free to download from a website that's on the last slide of my presentation. So you're free to use those and take a look at them. But anyway, this sort of partnership, this team orientation, and working with the agencies around their needs, I think was a big reason why we felt successful. The one I think we struggled the most with was this lack of fit, however. You know, we try to train a lot on, you know, how do you grapple with working in the gray areas when there's not an intervention that exactly fits your agency or your population. Mm-hmm. We used a lot of team discussions, a lot of empathy, a lot of validation of their frustration. But in the end, we felt fairly impotent to help them work through that particular issue. All in all, I think we were able to do a pretty good job of reducing mistrust and suspicion. I think that myself and my training partner, Betsy, I think we're pretty friendly people, and we try to be very humble. Somebody talked about being humble earlier and using sense of humor and validating frustration and things like that. I think that team members got a lot of new knowledge and skills. They were really, pretty excited about tools. You know, oh, wow, there's actually a very efficient way to search a database, and there's a way to do that. And I think that was very... satisfying to everybody. However, the agency teams, when we left, and the one thing they said, if you remember, I mentioned we did this sort of follow-up focus group with all three agencies together, they said, you know, we miss you. we felt like we were empowered to work through this process when we had a friendly neighborhood researcher to help us do it, but left on our own, it was extremely difficult, especially when it came to critical appraisal of very sophisticated research, and also when it came to implementation. So in some ways, I feel as though we left these teams sort of hanging, if you will, and I'll come back to this briefly. But some learning, I think, that we got from this experience, both the good and sort of the areas where we definitely could improve, was that we really came to think of evidence-based practice at a team or an organizational level rather than an individual process, mm-hmm. which I think some of the literature treats this as though a single practitioner on their own in isolation could just sort of go through these processes and magically practice evidence-based practice. But we actually came to see it as much more complex than that. Also, this notion that a long-term partnership is likely needed between researchers, or in our case, universities and agencies, if we really want to hope to see some change. And we think this has a benefit not just for increasing evidence-based practice, but also increasing the connection between the classroom and field experience for our students who come through our programs if we have partnerships. And we also came to appreciate the importance of supporting just a general culture of evidence-based practice in social work. So not just the technical expertise to find and apply evidence, but also to think about motivation. We had trouble with motivation and execution, even though we had relatively motivated partners and we were working with them. But sort of increasing values around the culture of transparency, client-centered practice, evaluation, and commitment to lifelong learning, despite the sort of limitations in the available evidence that we might have today, I think these are all sort of values that we can definitely increase to what somebody said earlier, just good social work practice. So I'm going to go ahead and, I guess, end there. Oh, and there's that website I mentioned where can download materials and also my email address. I realize I blew through this very quickly, so I'm always happy to follow up with emails or otherwise. So I appreciate your time.
Oh, cool. I love toys. Well, I don't know how much I'm going to have to worry about the time thing because, as you see, I'm drinking coffee, so I'm about 50 milligrams past the point of frightening the children, so I should be okay here. Oh, realize I'd better have this. Before I start, I would like to ask my colleagues and collaborators, actually, from JCFS to stand, Elizabeth Hutchins and Charlotte, and did Margaret, Charlotte Mallon, did Margaret buy much? She went home to take care of business. Okay. Well, one of the things that we haven't mentioned that should be stated outright is the amount of trust that it takes to let someone like all of us into an agency. Let's be very clear. We could do harm.
Yes.
I mean, I'm very serious about that. We could do harm. We could make things worse.
Exactly.
And I think that we need to acknowledge the amount of trust that it takes for someone to allow us into the agency to do this. Another thing that I thought Elsie's point was great about, the support she got from the dean. I have to acknowledge the support I've gotten from our dean for running around all over and spending a lot of time in agencies, and that is something that's, I think, a very important part of this. But let me talk a little bit about the project. I'm going to start with the end and then tell you how we got there. The evidence-based practice project, there were two sets of goals. The agency's goals were to introduce a system in which emerging practices are supported by empirical evidence, in which the empirical evidence would be implemented, and then to organize and manualize the agency's own best practices, or what Harold refers to as practice-based evidence. And the intermediate outcomes are to teach evidence-based practice skills to as many staff members as possible, and to embed the evidence-based process in the life of the agency through establishment of program EBP teams. And my goal, on the other hand, was to answer the question, can evidence-based practice be implemented and sustained in a community agency with agency resources That is dollars, you know, funding, time, staff, and infrastructure, and outside consultation. I need to emphasize from the very minute, from the first time we started conversation, this has been an agency project. This is not Stan McCracken's project. This is a JCFS project, and I'm kind of like a hired gun. Okay, so I'm an outside consultant that comes in and works with the agency. And I think that you want to keep that in mind. That's a very important piece of this. The reason I was interested in doing it this way is my belief that this evidence-based process has to be supported and with the impetus from educational institutions. If this is a university thing, it's not going to happen. Okay, it has to be something that can be maintained in the agency with absolutely some support and consultation from the academics. But if it has to come through the impetus of the university reaching out or from external funding and all of that stuff, it's probably not going to happen. Okay. Now, in terms of what I mean by the current status of the project. First of all, it's been 3 years since the project was implemented, so we're 3 years sustaining this project. Then there was plus another little less than a year of preparation and planning. So this has been going on now for 3 years, okay? And the model that we use is the one that you've seen before. We're talking about evidence-based process or evidence-based practice as a verb. And what I would like to do is to focus on a few lessons, and to pick in particular five. First of all, the fit between the innovation and agency values, goals, past experiences, and needs, the role of the champions, preparation of the agency for change, infrastructure support, and to quote a REO Speedwagon song, "Rolling with the Changes." Yes, I am of that generation. First of all, the agency context, Jewish Child and Family Services is a large urban, suburban family service agency. It has a number of very different programs with a wide variety of staff. So there are teachers, psychologists, social workers, occupational therapists, a chiropractor, for goodness sakes, so that it's not just a social work agency that provides services to children and families. Now, the fit between the innovation and the agency. First of all, there was a fit between the agency values and evidence-based practice. JCFS, and in fact, there was. I'm going to talk about the merger later, but when I walked in, it was actually half of the agency as it stands now. It's Jewish Children's Bureau. And JCB had a history of seeing itself as a learning organization. And that was very important. It was part of the DNA of the place. Right. And an important part of that. So this didn't happen as a result. This is what I walked into. Second, the goal of the agency strategic plan, and I've quoted it here, to create a rigorous research evaluation development process that drives a strategic systematic identification of emerging needs, fosters program innovation, and improves the quality of service delivery. So it's both part of the value of the agency and the goal. And we linked the evidence-based practice project to several different things that were happening and had either were well on its way or being implemented at the time. One was a Center for Practice Excellence, a Continuous Quality Improvement Project and Utilization Review Committee, a training group, and they were doing, for example, cognitive behavioral training, child-parent psychotherapy. There was a DCFS-funded project for children 0 to 5, and then systems of care. So that there was already some evidence-based interventions that were kind of in progress and happening at the time that I walked in. There's also a very strong history of staff and student training in the agency. This is seen as a place where this is a wonderful place for new graduates to go because the supervision and ongoing training was really top-notch. And that was, again, the history that I walked into. So one of the ways to think about JCFS is that these are what some people who in the dissemination and diffusion field would talk about as an innovator and an early adopter. And that was the characteristics of the agency. So this was the fit between evidence-based practice. Second was the role of the champions. First of all, there was strong administrative champion. Now, I'm using language from interactive staff training, which is a method that Pat Corrigan and I developed a number of years ago. Fred Steffen who is not able to be with us today, was the administrative champion. He's the one that really provided the impetus for this project. He was the one, he and I made contact, and he came to an evidence-based practice, this process training. I'd learned it from Len Gibbs, and then repeated it here at SSA as a professional development program, one-day training. And I, after the end of it, I said, is anybody interested in doing this? Because I'd like to work with you. And Fred came up at the end and said, let's talk about this. Let's have a conversation. And he had an agency role that, as an administrator. He was at that time associate executive director, and included oversight of some of these other activities, including the Center for Practice Excellence, CQI, QA, and training. He was also what's referred to in the diffusion field as an opinion leader. People since Fred isn't here, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Fred is a beloved person in the organization, beloved and highly respected. So, and one of the things I look for is when he talks, what do I see staff doing? You know, when you have a group of people, there is someone that when they talk, everybody's focused on them. Or if some other staff person says something, they check out to see the reaction of that person. That's Fred. Okay, when he's in the room, people are interested in what he thinks and what his opinions are. We also have a strong organizational champion, and Elizabeth Cannell, and I'm going to go ahead and embarrass her even though she's here. I'll pay for this later. She's a resource person for staff and administrators, and she was working with Fred and provided resources. So as part of our training, we had, instead of 10, we did it in 4 sessions, did the training in 4 sessions with homework, by the way. And Elizabeth was there helping with the homework. Now, one of the things I should tell you about the training, when I'm working with a community agency, I regard it as cheating if I have to rely on a resource that's available only because I'm faculty at University of Chicago. Everything I do with the agency, everything I do in the terms of the training is using databases and resources that are available to the general public. Okay? And one of the things, by the way, well, great resource almost nobody uses are the public libraries. I went to the Northbrook Public Library when I was doing this, and they have a person who is their IT electrical, electronic search person. She practically kissed me when I walked in the door because nobody ever asked to talk with her. And she said, she pointed this bank of computers, and she said, you see all these computers? And people were at them working. She said, this is where people get email, and I suppose they were downloading porn, but not to put too fine a point on it. And then there were 3 computers, nobody was there. And she said, these are hooked up to databases where people can search. They can download articles. Nobody uses them. So this is a great resource for those of you who are interested in doing this in the real world, outside of academia. She also has now taken over training role for the initial session. So basically, one of the things that I've tried to do is to clone myself. You know, if I have to keep doing all the training, they're not going to be able to afford it. Okay, because they're paying me as a consultant to come in. So Elizabeth has taken over the training for these initial sessions. She's also, by training, she's a writer and edited and put together an agency newsletter as part of the infrastructure support for this. And one of the things is that she's a non-clinician, and she's also not a recent grad. And I may ask, if she want to talk about that after we're done, then you might talk about that. As I saw that as important, because we don't get into that conversation about that she is driving this. She's providing technical support and doing searches and letting them have the clinical wisdom, the people that have that are doing the programs. Okay, the next piece is preparing the agency staff for change. Fred, the administrative champion, presented the project to program directors and senior management very early on, and led some small group discussions eliciting strengths and limitations of current programming, perceptions and concerns about evidence-based practice, and what would be needed to do it. And the concerns that were identified were almost identical to the ones that Jennifer talked about. you know, people said very clearly, this is not our, research is not our favorite course as students. And so one of the things that we did in putting together the training was to take those staff concerns very seriously. Also, when I do training and when Elizabeth now does training, we start with the objections. My belief is if people are going to object to something, you bring it up instead of letting them bring it up. So we start with, okay, here are the concerns that people have, and let's talk about it. There's also, and by the way, so, you know, they say sometimes that it's better to be lucky than good. During those first trainings, it turns out that one of our first evidence-based cohort of students, a graduate of our first SSA cohort, had been hired by JCFS, and she popped up in one of these trainings and said, oh, yeah, I learned how to do this at SSA. And of course, that, you know, having a stooge in the, someone planted in the audience is a great, it's really wonderful. You know, magicians do it all the time. Academics need to pay attention to that. Infrastructure support is another piece. Extensive ongoing support from administration. The agency newsletter I had mentioned already that shares clinical experience and research information, program feedback, links, resources, original columns and articles. Staff have access to computers with high-speed internet access. There's an agency in. Is anybody taping this? Turn the tape recorder off right now. There's an agency intranet for sharing articles. I mean, assuming that, of course, we're, you know, legal. And then there's also assistance for questions, searches, and locating evidence and implementation of interventions. So that all of this support from the agency has been happening. Now, the next piece of this is managing change. And one of the things I had mentioned was that there was a merger in the midst of all of this between two programs with very different kinds of staff, different kinds of programming. And the evidence-based project was started in Jewish Children's Bureau, but continued during and after the merger with Jewish Family and Child Services. I always get those letters mixed up there. And it was able to continue, and that was a decision. Should this be put on hold, or should it continue through this merger? And we thought, we've already started, let's just go ahead with it. And so then they gradually have included people from the second agency until now. It's pretty much we're doing it with both parts of the agency. And about, I guess, what was it, maybe 9 months ago, about a year ago, this beloved administrative champion went on a disability leave, and the technical leadership was kind of moved into two directions. Technical leadership was taken over by Elizabeth, but then the administrative leadership was passed by the to the chief operating officer, Margaret Vimont. And by the way, Charlotte, one of the things that she's done is now taking over a lot of the education part of this. So that is his role kind of got diffused into several different people, but there didn't seem that there was ever any question about this project continuing, which shows an amazing amount of organizational commitment. So, what's the take-home message? First of all, implementation of evidence-based practice for program development in community agencies is feasible. Mm-hmm. And it's something that can be done. And by the way, from day one, as soon as I heard Lynn Gibbs talking about this, I figured that the likelihood is that this is not mainly going to be used because of efficiency by individual practitioners. This is a program development tool, and we always talked about it that way. When any time in the agency is a program development tool, so we trained in teams the same way Jennifer did. The other thing, though, is we cannot underestimate the level of organizational commitment, preparation, and support to make this work. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot in order to keep this stuff going, to get it going, and especially to sustain it. 3 years to sustain a change project. We're into the part of the project, if you look at how projects seem to go, is that we're into the project now where there's adaptation. And one of the things that I didn't mention in terms of what's happening in our current goals, it looks like I may have skipped it, 120 staff have participated in the basic training. It's been added to the yearly training cycle, which Charlotte is in charge of, and they're currently assessing the degree to which staff are using the methods to locate relevant articles and to identify future directions for this project. So once again, thank you to JCFS, and thank you to you all. So, any questions, comments? Yes. That's what's happening now. That's their. The question is, how are people using this? What are they doing? Are people actually using it? Are they reading articles? So the question is, one of the questions, of course, is, are staff doing some of this? The other question is, it making a difference in agency practice? We're really, as far as I know, are you doing any assessment at that level? Of is it making a difference with the clients?
No, not at this time. I mean, we're tracking sort of how many programs are participating and how that number is growing, and then we're also doing things like surveys to ask people to look at the topics they're discussing and how often do they search for a clinical question on the internet.
We're really looking at this as augmenting the mission of their or the values as a learning organization.
Mm-hmm.
See, one of the things I see this as is as part of that learning organization, and at this point, that's where we are now. Actually, we did. We did. I don't have any of that stuff. But we asked how often were people reading articles, how often were they looking for information. You're still giving that to people. We got to talk. Yeah, but that's, by the way, this isn't, as you can just heard, this is not mine, that's theirs. Yeah. Gene.
I think it's very helpful insight from both Jennifer and from you that this is an extremely helpful programmatic tool and that you're evaluating it to some extent on an organizational level. But what are the implications of that for our teaching of individual practitioners and practitioner research and how they use evidence as they make decisions with individual cases?
I'm not sure if this works. I turn it off.
Okay.
I think that's a great question. I know as I've been teaching, sorry, closer? Is this not picking me up? Closer?
Closer.
It's like karaoke.
All right.
Here we go.
I'm too tall for the microphone. No, I mean, I just started, this is my first year. More transparency, teaching here at SSA and teaching evidence-based practice to master's students, and this issue comes up, which I do teach my class from a team perspective as well. I think particularly troubling to me or difficult to deal with is when we have social workers who are working relatively independently. I think about people who have their own private practice. I think about people who maybe are working in someone else's house, you know, the one social worker in the high school. And so I think we've got to start paying more attention to how to deal with those particular situations. But I have found, at least from my own experience and discussions with social workers, that to try to take that process on by themselves just feels absolutely overwhelming and unrealistic. So, I mean, I appreciate the comment. I think it's something to think more about.
The way I've handled it, I actually handle it a little bit differently. I teach an evidence-based clinical research course and then evidence-based clinical practice, and I handle it a little bit differently in the two. One of them is I do spend more time having them do it independently, and that's in the research course and the thinking about evaluating clinical outcomes. And one of the things, by the way, I teach goal attainment scaling, which is a method that you can use to evaluate any kind of an intervention. The question came up, well, what about, are you favoring cognitive behavioral? And this is something I'm working now with another community agency. God, these people trust me. Lord have mercy. The community agency now, and most of their practitioners are come from a psychodynamic model. We're using goal attainment scaling at Christopher House as an outcome measure for them. In the evidence-based clinical practice course, we talk a lot about the organization, and their final assignment is to present their evidence-based practice project to the agency, and I assign roles, agency roles, to all of the students, so that you have to think like the agency administrator, you have to think like the clinical director, you have to think like a consumer, you have to think like a family member, and ask those kind of questions.
Nothing like the good old days, but I wondered if the faculty here have ever thought of doing away with packets, because in the early days, before you could just have everything Xeroxed and given to students, all my students went to the library and they found out everything they could find out about what would help the clients that they were working with. Mm-hmm. I didn't make them do that. They did that because they wanted to know. And I thought I saw a major deterioration in library use. Some people graduate from here without ever going to the library I've heard. Just a rumor. So the idea of just doing away with clinical packets.
I do.
Good boy.
Yeah, I don't give students anything. They have to look up everything.
Absolutely.
They hate me for it, by the way. Nick, you want to
I know
to
they
them?
Do.
Yeah, no, yeah.
But it was exciting, and so I was thinking, if you don't do it that way, you can't generalize a skill you didn't learn in school to people in practice, and you can't teach them to have that skill if you don't have it yourself. Well, you can, but we faked it a lot. But nevertheless, you shouldn't.
Of course, as a field director, my mind is spinning on what a great opportunity this would be for partnerships between the university and the agencies where we place students for their field placements, because so often the integration piece, when there's mm-hmm. something different being taught in class mm-hmm. and then what's being practiced in the mm-hmm. field, you know, really creates kind of a challenge for the students. And so, you know, I would love to sort of think about ways that universities and agencies could work more closely together. And I'm thinking about all the labor intensiveness involved with this both, and also the motivation on the agency's part, because I think you're absolutely right. If they don't own it, it's not going to mean anything. Mm-hmm. But I think there's such an opportunity for a win-win situation here with a close partnership between university and agency, so that you're really reinforcing what the next generation of social workers are being taught and will bring to the agency, mm-hmm. so everybody's on board.
Would you like to hear about that? Nick, you want to talk about what you did at Gateway?
Yeah, about the engagement
project? Yeah. I interned at Gateway Foundation in Aurora this year, and another student, SSA student, and I started a project to engage waiting list clients, because they at Gateway Aurora they had seen like over a 50% drop-off rate from the clients that were put on the waiting list and that received services the year before. So we were sort of put in charge to start a project that would keep track of the waiting list every week, and we would call these the clients on the waiting list, do a brief motivational interview, and sort of engage them in services and offer them a support skill or support group every Monday that they could come to. And throughout the process, we tracked how many calls we made, you know, the clients, how many clients were coming, pre and post measures as far as, you know, their opinion of the agency. And through that, there was some initial results where we were able to show from the previous year, we were able to increase retention rates in the agency and increase client retention and engagement. So it was a great opportunity to merge research and clinical practice, because we were gaining skills in calling clients who were in crisis, who were sort of very, they were upset because they had been waiting for like months, because the average length of stay was like a year on the waiting list, and I think it still is. So Just offering that support was huge, and plus we had the research skills to be implemented at the agency and make a big impact as students. So.
And they hired him.
Yeah, just a brief mention. In Oregon, I do something a little different. I bring the agency or the community client into the classroom. I teach a number of service learning classes. They're called capstones, so they're six-hour classes. And I teach the five-step process to undergraduate students to work with the agency client right there. So cool. It's a different experience. So I'm listening to...
I like that.
That's cool. Yeah, but Gene's question and you all's points about, you know, what happens to the individual when they get back to the environment, and in Oregon, since evidence-based practice is a no-no and evidence-supported interventions is in vogue, the research utilization is, like, out the window.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'm actually trying to, a group of us, we're trying to change the legislation to broaden the definition of evidence of approved evidence-based perspectives. I'm trying to broaden it to include practice-based evidence, evidence-based management, along with evidence-based practice. We already have evidence-supported interventions. Let's have the other three in there also.
I'm so sorry we're out of time. I just want to thank our panelists.
Thank you.
We need to do this.
We could do a traveling show.
Yeah.